From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, as George W. Bush prepares to move into the White House, we look back on life in the Clinton White House with two men who work closely with the president. Paul Begala co-directed the campaign that got Clinton elected, then served as the president's political advisor. Leon Panetta was Clinton's first budget director and second chief of staff. The Clinton White House, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Defense Secretary William Cohen acknowledged today that American soldiers killed an unknown number of refugees early in the Korean War. Cohen said 15 months of investigations had established that U.S. troops killed refugees in the village of Nogunri in the summer of 1950. He said there's no evidence that the troops were acting under orders, and said the trouble was that the soldiers were young, poorly trained, and unprepared for North Korean battle tactics. President Clinton issued a statement expressing regret, but stopped short of an apology. A South Korean survivors group said the finding was a whitewash of a massacre. President-elect Bush's nominee for attorney general got some support today. Former Senator John Ashcroft was praised by conservative religious groups and advocates for victims' rights. More from NPR's David Wellner at the Capitol.
In response to a series of public events sponsored by Ashcroft's opponents, conservatives today held news conferences of their own to bolster his controversial and still unconfirmed designation as the nation's top law enforcement official. Family Research Council spokeswoman Janet Parshall warned at one gathering that Ashcroft is bound to set a new tone in Washington.
We are turning a corner here, and for a lot of people in this town, that's real scary. We're about to go back to the rule of law, where right is right, was wrong is wrong, and we're not going to raise a moistened finger in the air, check the polls, and find out how we're playing in Peoria.
Others praised Ashcroft's strong opposition to abortion, and they defended his effort while still a senator to block the nomination of a black judge, Ronnie White, to the federal bench. Crime victims held a separate event at the Capitol to express their support for Ashcroft. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
A violent winter storm is adding to California's power crisis. The state is in a Stage 3 power alert, which could bring rolling blackouts to some customers. The storm disabled a nuclear plant north of Los Angeles by blowing sea kelp into its intake lines. Another power station went offline last night. Following the kidnapping of an American aid worker, several humanitarian organizations have suspended their operations in Chechnya. NPR's Anne Garrels reports from Moscow.
Doctors Without Borders has suspended work in Chechnya after its main representative in the region, Kenny Gluck, was abducted. The United Nations has subsequently canceled a shipment of food to about 90,000 Chechens. The European organizations present there have also halted activities. This will seriously affect Chechen civilians who have received little aid from the Russian government, despite its pledges to the contrary. Before his kidnapping, Gluck had been extremely critical of the Russian authorities' lack of support. Russian officials have blamed Chechen rebels for the kidnapping, but the Republic's separatist leadership says it had nothing to do with it and will take all possible actions to liberate Gluck. Anne Garrels, NPR News, Moscow.
In stocks, the Nasdaq gained 4.6% today. This is NPR News. President-elect Bush has named a new choice for Secretary of Labor. Just 2 days after nominee Linda Chavez withdrew her bid, Bush named former Peace Corps Director Elaine Chao to the post. Chao, who's now a fellow at the Conservative Heritage Foundation, is married to Republican Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky. Bush also picked Robert Zoellick to become U.S. Trade Representative. Zoellick served in the Treasury Department during the Reagan administration and in the State Department during the Bush administration. The president of Bridgestone Corporation says he's resigning from the troubled tire maker. Jerome Vaughn reports from member station WDET.
Yoshiro Kazaki will step down from his role as president and chief operating officer in March, but will stay on as a full-time advisor to Bridgestone. The resignation comes in the aftermath of Firestone's recall of 6.5 million tires this summer because of a tread separation problem. Firestone is a division of Bridgestone. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration says it has linked the tires to 148 fatalities and more than 500 injuries in the U.S. Bridgestone Firestone's handling of the investigation into the problem tires also strained the company's relationship with one of its top customers, the Ford Motor Company. The tire maker is expected to post a loss of $500 million for 2000, its first loss in 8 years. For NPR News, I'm Jerome Vaughn in Detroit.
The Senate Armed Services Committee held a confirmation hearing today for Donald Rumsfeld, President-elect Bush's choice for Secretary of Defense. Rumsfeld, who ran the Pentagon during the Ford administration, said he'd push for a missile defense system and improve the military's force readiness. He also called for a substantial increase in funding for the Defense Department. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from NPR stations and Amgen, advancing the frontiers of medicine and improving the lives of patients through biotechnology.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. With just a little more than a week left in the Clinton presidency, we're going to look back on life in the Clinton White House. Our first guest is Paul Begala. He and James Carville ran the campaign that got Clinton into the White House. Begala later served as the president's political advisor. Begala is now a research professor at Georgetown University and a political analyst at MSNBC. He's also one of the people interviewed on the ABC Nightline and PBS Frontline co-production, The Clinton Years. Begala says when he met Clinton, he felt a stronger connection than he had with any other candidate he'd worked with.
It was the political equivalent of love at first sight. I'd been in the business for a while, and we had a mutual friend, Zell Miller, who was the governor of Georgia, whose campaign I had run, who was urging Clinton to hire James Carville and I, my partner. And we met with Clinton in 1991, and I was swept off my feet. I had never before had a politician who talked to me like I was a person and a citizen first and a strategist second. He didn't just say, here's how we can win New Hampshire and then get the nomination and then... He talked about his ideas. He talked about his daughter. He talked about the kind of country he wanted. And I was utterly charmed. I was completely swept off my feet.
And what did it mean to you that he talked about ideas?
Most politicians begin with the strategy and then work on the rationale. They begin by saying, well, my wife is from Illinois, and so that can help us in the Midwest. And I went to school in the Northeast, so that can help. And so they work backwards from there. They work through the how first, and then they tend to not want to think about the why. And he did it the right way. He did it the more difficult way, the more intellectually rigorous way. He began by saying, why should I be president? What ideas can I bring? And he had a very compelling case that the things he had worked on in Arkansas, education and economic development, were going to move center stage in a world in which there was no longer this central organizing principle of the Cold War. And it was very impressive analysis.
When you were first working with Clinton as a presidential candidate, what were some of the qualities you thought were his strongest ones and other qualities you thought he maybe had to change or hide from view?
His strongest quality is his empathy. Now, I say that even though he's the smartest person I know. He's an incredibly bright guy, but there are a lot of bright people in politics. I do think he's the brightest, but more than that, more impressive is the empathy. There are a lot of politicians who can sort of turn it on when the cameras are on, but then otherwise don't really care very much about people as individuals. He had this incredible ability to connect with people and to care about them, and it was real. It was right to the depth of his being, and I think that particularly showed itself on matters of race. He had the best ability to try to understand the racial divide in America and try to bridge it. Now, in terms of drawbacks, I mean, we all have them. I mean, certainly he had had stumbles in his life that he didn't want people to know about, and I found that to be eminently human and quite forgivable. Like a lot of politicians, he also sometimes wanted to get 100% of the vote instead of just the 51% you need to lead. That changed over time. I think by the time he became president and was working particularly with an opposition Republican Congress, he understood that there were some people that no matter what he did would never support him, and he reconciled himself to that. But at the start, I think he'd have been happy if he could have gotten 100%.
Now, the empathy, which you mentioned, is something that he was both liked for and also mocked for. So many of the comics did the whole I feel your pain thing, or him biting his bottom lip and right. You know, in a sign of thoughtfulness and sensitivity. Do you ever think the empathy got overplayed for the cameras?
No, I know that you're right, that he got a lot of criticism for that, but it was real, and I thought it was wonderful, and I think it's one of the reasons the American people hung in there with him for so long. That line, "I feel your pain," he blurted out in a real, in a fit of pain. He was in New York, and he was giving a speech, and an AIDS activist stood up and was yelling at him that the government hadn't done enough about AIDS, that he in Arkansas perhaps had not done enough about AIDS, and he didn't patronize the man. He engaged him, he argued with him, and then finally it just came pouring out of him. He said, "You know, I feel your pain, and I am trying to do something about it, and I want to go to Washington to make sure we do more." Well, you know, he has. I mean, obviously, we still have AIDS. It's still a terrible, terrible disease and a crisis, but he's done a lot more for that issue and that disease than any prior president. Certainly, President Reagan could never bring himself to even say the word. So I, to this day, have always loved and admired him for his empathy and his ability to feel other people's pains. And I think that's probably one of the most important things a president can have, because it's a very isolating office. It's a place where everybody kisses your ring, where you're treated quite well physically. There's very little harm that can come your way, thank goodness. But I do think it also tends to isolate and kind of deaden the soul a little bit if you're not someone who's very well connected to how real people live.
When you took on the Clinton campaign with James Carville, did you check out his past and see what personal skeletons might be in the closet?
No, we didn't. You hear rumors about everybody, but this is what we did for a living, was work for politicians. I was more interested in what he stood for. I was more interested, frankly, in his prospects of winning. Those are the two things that I checked out. I talked to other politicians who I respected, and I mentioned before Zell Miller, who was then the governor of Georgia. He's now a senator from Georgia. I talked to people like that, but I was not interested in trying to root around to see if he was somehow morally fit. I don't like that kind of politics.
But those skeletons became your problems. What was your reaction when the Jennifer Flowers story broke?
I was nauseous. And to this day, when I think about it or hear about it, it kind of turns my stomach for a variety of reasons. First off, at some level, I feel his pain. Unfortunately, there's a whole lot of people in life who have challenges in their marriage. That's tragically common. What's not common is to have your marriage strip searched like that in front of the whole world. And I just can't imagine what it must be like to have your weakest moments splayed out there for the entire world. I never did feel like it was anybody's business except his and Hillary's. And, call me old-fashioned, but I'd pin a medal on the two of them for holding it together. I mean, he is still married to a gal he met in the library 25 years ago. And they've had their ups and downs, but that's better than 50% of the married population in America.
Is there anything you learned through the Clinton campaign that disproved any of your own theories about campaigning?
Yeah, a lot. One was, everybody believed in this business that if, given what happened to Gary Hart, if there were plausible charges of infidelity, that was the end of it for you. One of the things Clinton taught me is if you just don't give up, if you just don't give in, you can survive. He is the most resilient guy I've ever seen. And I think that is undervalued in politics. We tend to want these people just to go away when they're hit with a scandal. And very often they just want to go away because they can't take it. And he just has this incredible, incredible resilience, this ability to carry on without becoming bitter, without obsessing about it, but instead really trying to put it aside in a box and move on with the job he's being paid to do. I just didn't think anybody could possibly just get up in the morning after some of the days that he had, and he was always ready to. And that proved to me that if you're willing to take the punch, people will give you the credit and let you dust yourself off and move on.
Paul Begala is my guest, and he helped run President Clinton's campaign with James Carville, and he was a political advisor in the Clinton White House from 1997 to 1999. Robert Reich, who was Secretary of Labor during the early part of the Clinton administration, said that when he was given an order, he started asking if the person that gave the order was under 30, and if they were under 30, he'd refuse to do it. Was there a generation gap in the White House?
Yes, and I was always struck that the baby boomers who used to say, don't trust anyone over 30, all of a sudden didn't trust anyone under 30. I thought there was an enormous tension between the kids, and I suppose I was one of the kids.
Well, you were 30. You were kind of right in that transition.
Boomers. I was right there. I was the middle child.
Right.
I was caught
that
in the middle.
That in-between age.
Yeah, I found that odd, but real. I mean, here we had a president who had been the governor of his state when he was about 31 or 32, about my age. And yet sometimes he would look at some of these people younger than him and say, well, my goodness, they're young. But, you know, I mean, our current vice president-elect, Dick Cheney, was the White House chief of staff at age 31 or 32. When Bill Moyers and Ted Sorensen had some of the most senior jobs in the White House for Presidents Johnson and Kennedy, they were in their very early 30s. So it's always been that way. I think, though, that with the baby boomers, they were always used to being the youngest person in the room. And all of a sudden, the president and Bob Reich and some of the others looked up and they said, oh, my goodness, they're talking to us like we're nearing 50. And they were. And I think it shook out over time and everybody adjusted to the change.
My guest is Paul Begala. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about life in the Clinton White House with Paul Begala, who was the president's political advisor after co-running the campaign that got him elected. There must have been a strange transition that happened in your relationship with Bill Clinton when he went from being the person who you were advising in his presidential campaign to actually being Mr. President. Did the relationship change, and if so, how? Maybe you can give us an example of how relating to Bill Clinton changed once he became the president.
You're right, Terry. It changed very quickly and very dramatically. I traveled with him through the campaign. I sat next to him on the plane. We had endless, wonderful, wide-ranging conversations about music and religion a lot. I'm a Catholic. He's a Baptist. I grew up in the Bible Belt. He went to Catholic schools, and so we each have a real interest in the other's religious tradition. We talked, obviously, a lot about politics, but also about family. I was just starting to have children, and he had told me the whole story of how he and Hillary got to have Chelsea. So we developed a very intimate relationship. And the morning after the election, he said to me, I want you to call me Bill. It's important that you call me Bill. And I looked at him and I said, you know, I never called you Bill when you were just the governor of Arkansas. I can't call you Bill now. You're the president-elect. And there was a transition period where he seemed hesitant, almost uncomfortable with the trappings of power. And it took us all a while, I think, to readjust and to become comfortable with the majesty of the office and that part of the function, which President Reagan understood intuitively because of his experience as an actor. He understood that there's a role-playing function there. President Clinton, being of a different generation, I think wanted to demystify the presidency quite a bit, and I think he did to an extent. But I also think we came to understand the value and the power of the majesty and the moment of the presidency.
Well, as an advisor, as you started to get a better understanding of the majesty of the office, how did that change, if at all, the advice you gave Clinton about how he should relate to the public?
I had to be a lot more careful about what I said to him. The campaign is obviously a very small group of people. Maybe even most key decisions were made by half a dozen of us or less. And then you move into the government, and even a meeting with six people in it becomes front page news in the New York Times the next day. And so I had to become very careful. I made it my business to be as in private as critical as I could and in public as praising as I could. That's my definition of loyalty. I think a loyal aide has to really hammer the president when you're alone, when there's nobody else in the room, because they get a whole lot of sugar-coated information. How that changes in how you relate to the public, I've always been struck that the public, at least to me, they always call him Bill. Every time I travel, people say, how's old Bill doing? You know, Bill did a good job on that crime bill. You ought to congratulate him for that. They feel a sense of ownership of this guy, I think, because they created him, and then they sustained him. When everybody in Washington wanted to get rid of him, it was just popular opinion and average what Clinton calls walking around folks that sustained him. So I think they always saw him as their guy in Washington. And even when he became more comfortable with the trappings of power, and God, he loves Hail to the Chief now, believe me. He never seemed to leave those kind of walking around folks out.
Now, you said that you tried to be very critical in private and very supportive in public. I think we've all seen you being very supportive of Clinton on television. Maybe you can compare for us an issue in which what you said in public was different from what you said in private.
Well, I mean, there are a lot of issues where I would privately disagree with him, but then once a decision is made, you've got to get on board. I mean, the most carefully documented one was the whole economic plan that Clinton put together, where I, as his political advisor, said, look, if you promise a middle-class tax cut and then begin with a tax increase, even a small one on gasoline like we had, people could be very upset. It didn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that would hurt him politically. He made the decision that it was more important. I was really proud of that decision. Here was this intensely political animal, knowing full well he was going to take an action that would be very politically damaging, but he thought it would be good for the economy, thought it would be good for the country. So I publicly defended that economic plan. I helped him to sell it, and I was happy to do so, even though there were a lot of particulars in there that I didn't much like. My view is that's the price of teamwork, is that you make your argument, you state your case in the strongest possible terms, and then once a decision is made, unless it's something that completely runs contrary to your conscience, you've got to support it.
Well, because you were such the public supporter all the time and often on the TV talk shows, speaking out in support of President Clinton, even early on in the Monica Lewinsky story, you were speaking on his behalf when very few other people would. Did you ever find yourself saying things that you weren't sure you really believed?
Well, I had no idea what the truth was. That was a terrible time. That was really dancing in the dark. You know, like he never told me anything different than he told the public at large. He said, you've got to believe me. This stuff isn't true. And to his credit, he said, I can't tell you anymore or they'll drag you into it. And you'll be in front of the grand jury and you'll have $100,000 of legal bills. And I don't want that for you. I'm going to handle this. But you just got to believe it's not true. I know he shouldn't have done that. And I had a very hard time with that. When I realized finally, and he came forward and said that he had in fact had an affair, you know, I came very close to resigning, and I would have resigned, but for the fact that they tried to impeach him. And then it became a question of where do I owe my highest duty? And it seemed to me I was paid by the taxpayers to serve the Constitution. And even if I was angry with my friend, the president, and I was furious, I had a higher duty to the country to try to stop what I felt was an absolutely illegitimate and partisan impeachment. You know, if they had done with Clinton what the Democrats did with Reagan over Iran-Contra, which is to say, we're not going to impeach you, but we want the whole country to know you lied. You lied to us, Mr. President. You said we didn't trade arms for hostages, and we did. I don't know that I could have stayed with him then, but he, in that sense, was saved by his enemies because they once again tried to go so far, and it showed me that it really wasn't about anybody's sense of morality at all. It was just about power and politics, and I then felt very comfortable in defending him because I felt like I was defending the Constitution more than Bill Clinton, the man.
You had defended Bill Clinton back when he was saying that he didn't have a relationship with Monica Lewinsky. Then you learned the truth, and you went through this period of thinking maybe you'd resign, as you just described. When you went back on TV, Ted Koppel asked you this question. He said, since you were sent out on a number of occasions to lie in the president's behalf, what guarantees do I have, what guarantees do our viewers have that you aren't being sent out now to do the same thing? Did you feel that your support of the president early on was seen as a reflection of your credibility or your lack of credibility? Was it personally upsetting to you that you had said things that you later found out weren't true?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Of course, I had no idea that they were false. I would have never said them if I'd known that. But it did damage my credibility, as it has to. And I thought Ted's question, while brutally tough, was perfectly fair. It was the only honest way to begin that kind of an interview. When the president came forward and confessed that he'd in fact had an affair that he had told me to deny, I went through, as I said, a very difficult time, and I went for quite some time refusing all interviews, refusing to defend him in public any longer. And what changed my mind and sent me back out was watching the videotape of Clinton being interrogated by the special prosecutors. And they asked him questions that nobody should be asked. The most tawdry, intimate details of his worst moments, even after he began the session by confessing to having had an affair. They didn't take that confession, and they just said, well, we're going to try to humiliate you. And I was so moved by what I thought was this manifest mistreatment that my friend had received that it actually helped me to forgive him. It didn't make it all right, and it didn't excuse it. But, you know, in my religious tradition, if someone comes to you and says, I've done something wrong, I am asking for your forgiveness, it's not easy. In fact, it was enormously difficult, and maybe I haven't perfectly achieved it yet. But it's my obligation to forgive, or else it becomes my sin. And so that's what was going on inside of my heart and my head. But I thought it was perfectly fair for journalists to say, how can we believe you now when you told us things that were false in the past? And it's why in my comments from then on, I confined myself to the known and provable public record. And then 6 days after he was acquitted by the Senate, I quit.
And why did you quit then?
Well, my work was done. I didn't want to continue on. I had spent a very, very intense couple of years on the White House staff. And I felt like defeating this completely illegitimate impeachment had probably taken the last full measure of what I had to give my country and my president. It was probably better for him to get a team of fresh horses in there. And I do think that he needed new people and fresh faces because of the difficulty and the divisiveness of that fight, and also because of that long period when he was simply unable or unwilling, rather, to confess to this affair.
Did you or any other consultants in the White House or, you know, aides in the White House ever give Clinton a keep-it-in-your-pants kind of lecture?
It's not. I was not his nanny, no. That's not my job. I don't know whether anyone else did, but, you know, he's an adult, and it's not my business. I'm not in the habit of telling my friends how to live their private lives, much less my employers.
Paul Begala is President Clinton's former political advisor. He'll be back in the second half of the show. One correction, in Robert Reich's interview for the Nightline Frontline series, he said he didn't want to take orders from people under 40, not under 30, as I said earlier. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, and from Random House Incorporated's Delta Trade Paperbacks Division, publisher of How to Think Like Leonardo da Vinci, 7 Steps to Everyday Genius by Michael J. Gelb, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation about the Clinton White House with Paul Begala, also creating a more grown-up environment in the White House. We talk with Leon Panetta about the changes he made when he became Clinton's second chief of staff.
Mm-hmm.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're talking about life in the Clinton White House. Let's get back to our interview with Paul Begala. He and James Carville ran the campaign that got Clinton into the White House. Begala later served as the president's political advisor. Bill Clinton spoke of Hillary as his greatest asset during the campaign and used to say, you know, if you make me president, you're getting two for the price of one. Now, some of Clinton's advisors complained that Hillary had perhaps too much power in the relationship because nothing that the aides wanted done would get done, even if Clinton agreed to it, unless Hillary agreed as well. Do you think that that's an accurate reading of the relationship? And was her say in policy, in your mind, a good thing, or did it interfere, do you think, with things that you were trying to get done?
For 17 years, I guess, have been dealing with politicians. I no longer do it for a living. But everyone I ever worked for who was married had an influential spouse. And that just goes with the territory. I mean, I worked for Dianne Feinstein for a while. She's a senator from California. And I used to start every day by calling her husband, Dick Blum, and seeing what he thought about things. I mean, any smart staffer is going to want to know what the principal's spouse thinks, because that man or woman is always going to have the last word if they have any kind of a normal relationship. I can understand how it's difficult for staff people, but I guess I always knew that that came with the territory. It was always the same, as I say, with every senator, every governor I ever worked for. And it's part of the human condition. If you're married and you're any kind of a decent spouse, you're going to listen to your spouse.
Do you feel that you understand why people on the right so despise Hillary and Bill Clinton? Why it became so personal?
No, it's a real mystery to me. I understand why they oppose their ideas. I think some of it does drive them crazy, and I feel for them that way, and I vowed never to let Governor Bush drive me equally crazy, because they seemed odd people to pick as villains. I remember once Newt Gingrich called them countercultural McGovernicks. Now, these are people who spend New Year's Eve at a Renaissance weekend talking public policy and singing God Bless America at the stroke of midnight. Not my idea of countercultural McGovernicks, whatever that means. I've never understood the personal animus, the hatred, and it is raw. Terry, I got hate mail like you wouldn't believe just from working for him.
Just to tell me about some of what you got.
Oh, volumes and volumes, really. I mean, just stacks and stacks. When I left the White House, my assistant gave me many volumes of loose-leaf binders that she'd collected. I found it inspirational. I mean, a lot of it just hateful and bigoted, but some of it quite inspirational. I figured if we're making the kooks that angry, we're doing something right.
Now, I heard that during the Gore-Bush debates that Gore's aides played him tapes of the Saturday Night Live parodies of the debate so he could see what he was doing wrong or what people perceived that he was doing wrong. Did you ever play tapes of comics impersonating Bill Clinton to give him a sense of what people were responding to, for better or worse, about his mannerisms or his way of speaking?
No, and in fact, in fairness to the Gore gang, I was around for those debate preps because I played Bush for Gore in those mock debates, and they really just played him those tapes for fun. They thought they were funny sketches. In the campaign, we played Clinton all the Saturday Night Live spoofs on his campaign, not to teach him any lessons. We just thought they were funny, and Clinton's got an enormous ability to laugh at himself. There were long stretches, of course, where the topics of the jokes, particularly on the late-night shows, were too painful and too personal, and he would just tune them out. He was the first president, I think, in the television era who didn't have a television in his office. It'll be interesting to see if President-elect Bush changes that and goes back to, you know, LBJ had three televisions going all the time, plus the UPI and the AP wires. Clinton had no media in his office. He didn't have any wires.
Why?
He didn't have any computer.
Especially
really
in the CNN
him.
Era and now the MSNBC era as well.
I think he liked being one step removed. He came into my office once. And I had the TV going, of course, all the time on these news networks. And it was somebody, you know, screaming and yelling about what a horrible man he was. And he put his hand on my shoulder and he said, "Why do you watch this stuff?" And I said, "Well, sir, so you don't have to." And he did. He kind of laughed and said, "Okay, well, good for you. I couldn't take it." I think it's important, and it was a learned skill. on the part of President Clinton, who used to devour anything that was about him in the press. It was a learned skill to step back from that, and a healthy one. And I think that it probably helped the president to not see the day-to-day news coverage of that whole thing.
I wonder if you're leaving the Clinton era with a sense of optimism or pessimism about American politics.
Well, you know,
having
writ
lived through the impeachment, yeah.
Right. In the big picture, in the big sense of things, very optimistic that we can get a lot done in this country, and the politics matters, and that it can be on the level that you can go to the country and you can say, look, if you make me president, I'll cut the deficit, I'll revive the economy, I'll address welfare and crime, I'll do the best that I can to solve these ancient hatreds in the Middle East and Northern Ireland. And then he went and did all those things. I mean, I wrote half of those campaign speeches, and they were not just pie in the sky, they were a whole floating bakery. And doggone it if he didn't do it all. So in that sense, I leave very optimistic. I have a lot of friends who work for Governor Bush because I'm from Texas, and I worry about them in the small and personal ways that you worry about your friends. I've seen more friends that I can count financially ruined and emotionally destroyed by this politics of personal destruction. I do hope that President Bush has an easier go of it, that his political adversaries don't mistake him for an enemy and try to take him down by any means necessary the way the right did against Clinton. I think that's what's been difficult and disillusioning, is the abuse of the law, of prosecutorial apparatus, and of journalism to such a vicious and vindictive end. And I hope, as maybe one of the faces of the loyal opposition against Governor Bush, I hope just to give him hell every day, but not to cross that line and try to pretend that just because I think he's wrong politically that somehow we have to put him in prison.
Paul Begala, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It's a pleasure.
Paul Begala is President Clinton's former political advisor. Coming up, President Clinton's former chief of staff, Leon Panetta. This is Fresh Air. We're looking back on life in the Clinton White House. My guest, Leon Panetta, was President Clinton's first director of the Office of Management and Budget. In Clinton's second year in the White House, he appointed Panetta chief of staff, replacing Clinton's old friend Thomas Mack McClarty. Panetta left the White House in 1996 after Clinton's reelection. Now he lives in California and runs the Panetta Institute, a bipartisan study center for the advancement of public policy. I asked him what he most wanted to change when he took over as chief of staff.
Well, there were three things that I think I really had to focus on as chief of staff. One was establishing a chain of command in the White House. There really was no organization chart, and people were not responsible to any level of discipline. So what I first did was basically establish a kind of basic organization chart that had myself, two deputies, and the chief of staff's office responsible to the rest of the staff and in control of the rest of the staff. Secondly, to establish greater discipline within the White House so that people understood that they couldn't simply walk into the Oval Office, but they would have to go through the chief of staff's office in order to do that, and to improve the method of briefing the president. And then thirdly, to establish as much as possible a focus for the president. He seemed to be going after all issues at all times, trying to be all things to everybody. And very frankly, that's not a good use of the bully pulpit. You've got to create a focus. And so we were able to develop a very tight scheduling approach and to say, you know, these are the priorities, these are the issues that the administration is going to be about. And the president, to his credit, accepted that.
When you established the chain of command and made it impossible for people to just walk right into the Oval Office, did some of the people in the administration see you as creating just a more hierarchical structure and ruining some of the idealism in the White House?
Well, there's no question that, particularly those who kind of came out of the campaign and had become accustomed to dealing with the president as a candidate, thought that that was the way they ought to deal with him as president. But the problem with that is that, obviously, for a president who has to face a number of issues and a number of problems and has very limited time, it can create virtual chaos. You just can't have everybody dealing with the president every time they thought they wanted to speak to him. And so I think the president himself recognized the need for discipline, the need for a stricter organization. And I felt that if I was going to be successful as chief of staff, but more importantly, if the president was going to be successful, that this was the only way to do business.
When you were White House chief of staff, were there many calls you got at 3 or 4 in the morning?
Oh, yeah. That's one of the things I don't miss is getting those calls in the middle of the night because it's usually not good news.
And, yeah. What were the issues that woke you up at 3 or 4?
Well, I can remember soon after I became chief of staff, I got a call. I think it was about 2:30 or 3 o'clock in the morning from a Secret Service agent. And he said, I'm sorry to wake you up, but I have to tell you that a plane just went into the White House. And I said, you've got to be kidding me. He said, no, a plane went into the White House. I said, well, was it a DC-10? Was it a 747? He said, no. No, it was just a light plane and it went up against the White House. And we think, may have damaged the Jackson Magnolia tree, but that's about it. I said, yeah, but I said, is it a diversion? Is this an effort to go after the president? Do we know whether there, this is some kind of assault against the president? Have you checked out the plane? And it tells you a little bit about the state of what's happening these days with regards to the news. But here's a Secret Service agent, and he says to me, according to CNN News, we don't think there's a problem. I said, no, I don't care about what CNN News is reporting. I want you to go out there and find out what's in that plane, if there's dynamite or if there's explosives. And that gives you an idea of some of the issues that that chief of staff has to deal with.
Did you watch CNN a lot to figure out what was going on?
Well, interestingly enough, in this age of technology and information that speeds across the country in seconds, the reality is that for all of the intelligence agents we have and all of the satellites we have and all of the information sources we have, nothing is faster than a report on CNN News or the kind of 24-hour news stations that we have now on different cables. I mean, that's a reality. And I'll tell you another story. I was went down to the basement of the White House to look at the Situation Room when I became chief of staff and asked to see the information center where all of this information came in. And they showed me a corner where there were a couple soldiers sitting there in uniform. And what they were doing was watching CNN News. So that is the principal information source that now flows into the White House. They tell me they've added a few others since then.
I think it was in 1994 that Dick Morris became President Clinton's political advisor. Now, I know that there were several people in the Clinton administration who really didn't like Dick Morris. What made him so unpopular with part of the administration that was already there?
Well, Dick Morris is a political consultant, he is a political consultant who relies on polls and focuses on winning, like most political consultants do. He doesn't bring really a particular ideology to his profession or beliefs. He basically operates on doing what you have to do in order to win. So you introduce a consultant like that into the White House to a staff that is professional, that is working on issues, that believes deeply, whether it's in education or health care or in foreign policy efforts by the administration. And suddenly someone goes walking in who says, this is what the polls show, this is what you should or shouldn't do. It creates almost immediate antagonism to that individual.
Did Dick Morris ever interfere with your work, or did the polling interfere with your work?
Well, my view was that First of all, I mean, there is a role for consultants to play, but it is a role that they should play on the political process and in the campaign. And so we early on established a process whereby the president would have political meetings and Dick Morris could present his information at those political meetings. As to any decisions that were made on policy, that would flow through me as chief of staff to the staff, and we would, again, evaluate those issues to make sure that from a policy point of view, they were the right thing to do for the president. Now, I will tell you that at first, Dick Morris began to walk around the White House and begin to go in and talk to staff members individually. And as soon as I had gotten information that he was doing that, I went straight to Dick Morris and to the president and made very clear that that could not happen, because you cannot allow a political consultant to assume that he can run the White House. That just should not happen, and it didn't happen once I went to the president.
My guest is Leon Panetta. We're talking about life in the Clinton White House. Leon Panetta served as the budget director and as the White House chief of staff. Monica Lewinsky was your intern before working with President Clinton. What was your reaction when you heard that it was alleged that they had had intimate relations?
Well, I was shocked. First of all, that it had happened. But secondly, that it had happened with someone who actually had not been working in the White House. I had my policy as chief of staff was to not have White House interns working in the West Wing itself, because I felt that would be a dangerous approach. Not because there aren't White House interns who can assume some of those responsibilities, but the reality is that you don't know everything about the background of a White House intern, and that they are young, and that I thought it was dangerous to expose them to the kind of sensitive issues that the White House was dealing with. So generally, White House interns did not come over to the White House. What happened at that time was that because of the government shutdown, we were required, as every other agency, to not have our personnel show up. And so to try to replace personnel that had to be let off as a result of the shutdown, we did use some of the White House interns to answer phones. And so she had actually just come over for one day, maybe two or three days, I guess. And then that was it. We then sent her back to her normal White House intern responsibilities. And then, frankly, I kind of lost track of her. And then when the story came out, I was back in California, and realized that this had happened, it was for me just, again, a total shock.
Did you believe the story? Or did you believe the president?
My view was that for a president as bright and capable as this president, who loved the office of the presidency so much and enjoyed the challenges that were part of the office of the presidency, and cared so much about the issues that he was working on, that there was no way I thought this person would in any way risk that presidency on that kind of behavior. I mean, I just never believed that he would do something like that. And that's why, when the story came out, it was a surprise, because I think it caught all of the staff by surprise, because no one believed that he would do something that stupid when you're president of the United States, and particularly with this president.
Did it change your estimation of Bill Clinton as a man or as a president to know that he really did have an intimate relationship with her?
I think what bothered me more than anything about what took place was not so much the fact that it happened, because, when those things happen, it isn't just the responsibility of one person, there are two people that are involved, and I didn't feel I could be a judge of what actually happened in that relationship. But what concerned me more than anything was the failure to acknowledge that it had happened and to be truthful with the American people about what had happened, because I think ultimately, you know, for all of the great things he did as president, one of the things that you can't break is the bond of trust between the American people and the president. And when you do that, it undermines your ability to lead the nation.
You had to testify before the before Kenneth Starr's grand jury, and I'm wondering if you were angry during the testimony at all, angry about having to be put through that, and if so, whether you were more angry at the president or at Ken Starr.
Well, it's never a pleasant experience, I think, for anybody to go through that kind of proceeding, even though, you know, I had nothing to hide, and obviously, you know, was not concerned about anything that related to me. So, it wasn't, and I didn't even hire a lawyer when I did that, because, I felt I had nothing to hide, and I would present and answer all of the questions that were presented to me. So that wasn't the problem. But going before them so soon, I guess, after the story had broke and the kind of circus atmosphere that developed around the grand jury hearings and having to go through that, I think that concerned and bothered me more than anything. But especially for someone like myself who's been in and out of Washington over the last 30 years, I kind of accepted what was happening as one of those things you have to go through periodically in Washington.
My guest is Leon Panetta, President Clinton's first budget director and second chief of staff. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Leon Panetta is my guest. We're talking about life inside the Clinton White House. He served as budget director and White House chief of staff in the Clinton administration. A couple of snapshots for us. Can you just give us the moment in which you were proudest to be in the Clinton White House and the moment in which you felt most disappointed in the president?
Oh, well, there's no question. I think the proudest moment for me in the White House is, I mean, one of them was clearly the passage of the economic plan and putting that in place, because that made such a tremendous difference in terms of where our economy ultimately has gone. And I think that'll always be my proudest moment as director of the Office of Management and Budget. But actually, the moment I remember best was when the president looked at Newt Gingrich during the government shutdown and basically said to him, after a long series of negotiations, I cannot accept what you want me to do in your budget. I think it's wrong for the country, and it may cost me the election, but I'm not going to do it. And it was at kind of that moment that I said, you know, the president understands what it's all about. He's willing to draw a line. And I guess that was the moment that I was proudest of him, because he was willing to say that in a very tough negotiation and a very tough moment in terms of the history of this country. I don't think there's any question that obviously the moment that was most disappointed with him was not really during a time when I was in the White House, but after I had left with regards to this whole Lewinsky matter, because it really concerned me. And again, what concerned me was not so much what had happened, it was the fact that he looked the American people in the eye and didn't tell him the truth.
What was it like for you when you had to tell the president something he didn't want to hear, when you were chief of staff?
I never had a problem doing that, even though, president didn't like to hear it, and he has a temper and would sometimes react against it. I felt it was my job as chief of staff, again, to be very frank with him about what was happening. If something good was happening, I'd love to tell him that. But if something bad was happening, it was my responsibility as chief of staff to tell him as well. And to his credit, even though he would be concerned about it or he would be angry about it, it did not take him very long to get his feet back on the ground and to return to the job of being president of the United States. He does really have this capacity to compartmentalize these kinds of problems. It'll put him aside, and if he's dealing with issues that involve the presidency, he will focus on it 100% and do his job, even though these other problems are developing. So he's one of a kind. I don't think we're going to see a Bill Clinton, with all of the qualities that he had, both good and bad, I don't think we're going to see that kind of president for a long time.
How do you think life in the Bush White House will compare to what life was like in the Clinton White House?
I have no idea. I have no idea I don't even think that George Bush probably has much idea either, because the reality is, for all the plans you make and for all the people you appoint to positions, you don't know what the hell's going to happen until you walk into the Oval Office and have to deal with people and have to deal with the kind of crises and problems that face the president. It's at that moment that you will find out whether this is a team that can pull together and be able to deal with issues. I mean, he's got a lot of experience both in the cabinet and in some of the people around him. Clearly, Dick Cheney has a lot of experience in those jobs. So he's got a lot of experience to fall back on, and that can be helpful. But at the same time, the ability of that team to work together, to respond to discipline, to be able to operate in an organized fashion, to deal with crises, all of that remains to be seen.
Leon Panetta, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Leon Panetta was President Clinton's first budget director and second chief of staff. He's also one of the people featured in the ABC Nightline and PBS Frontline co-production, The Clinton Years. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Monique Nazareth, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Joan Tui Westman, with Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, and Patty Leswing. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From BEA, providing the WebLogic e-business platform, infrastructure software for the development and deployment of e-business applications, BEA.com. And from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The new movie, 13 Days, starring Kevin Costner, is about the Cuban Missile Crisis. On the next Fresh Air, the secret documents from the crisis, including letters by Kennedy, Khrushchev, and Castro. We hear from Tom Blatton of the National Security Archive. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.